Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September the 19th, 1995. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Susan Ballinger. Her subject, Trees, Shrubs, and Flowers of Holden. Let's listen in.
Well, thanks for coming. I'm Susan Ballinger, and today we're going to look at the plants, the trees, the shrubs, the flowers that grow around Holden Village. I discovered a great resource when I was up here last time. A teacher apparently put together a slideshow and took photos of the flowering plants that are here. So I've been madly taking pictures all summer, and then I get to use one that's already well done. So it's a neat resource. So if just so you know, up at the Mining Museum is a whole series of labeled Kodak carousel reels on different topics. And all you need to do is ask one of the staff, just to let them know you're up there, if you wanted to look at those. The one I showed on birds is part of the collection here.
Do you want an animal too?
Well, no, they don't have one on mammals. I have a few slides, and mammals are hard to take pictures of. And you don't see mammals as much. You mostly see signs.
I'm curious about this little ground squirrel. Because they were, you know, they're disappearing now. But they were, you know.
Well, we have it's the golden mantled ground squirrel, and they're striped to their neck. And then mixed in with them are also the chipmunks, which are striped to the nose. And the ground squirrel are just real opportunistic, and they are storing food. They also hibernate in the winter, so they do store some food for lean periods, but they hibernate.
They just sort of disappeared about a week ago.
Right.
And they're out in the woods now. When I take the walks, I notice they're carrying little pine cones in their mouths.
Oh, yeah.
I suppose they're storing them. I don't know where they live, but I mean, I'm curious.
Well, they have underground burrows, and a lot of them in the rock works here. I wanted to just give you kind of an overview of if you want to start learning plants. Again, it's kind of like birds. It's this fun thing to start on that you do for years. And it's every year you get to start over because spring comes and flowers come up. So it's one of those things that's just a great lifelong hobby. There are a couple ways to get started. If you want to really be hardcore and you want to do it as a botanist, you want to start to learn the characteristics of families. Now, most of you have roses in your yard, and you know what a rose fruit looks like. Well, you could probably, if you're walking around the forest, you can see some things in our forest that sort of look rose-ish, that have some of those same characteristics. So there are ways of learning the different families. In a book like this is a field guide to Pacific State wildflowers, and there's some for eastern flowers. Pretty much wherever you go in the country or wherever you live, you can buy a field guide like this. And in the front, they have what's called a key. And botanists use things called keys to figure out what family it's in. So if you don't know if it's in the rose family or not, you start with something called a key, and it's a matter of making either or choices. To make a key, a botanist has all the possible flowers in front of him or her, and you divide them into two groups, and then you take this group and divide into two, and take this group and divide into two. So you can build a forked key, and at each junction on the key you have to make a choice. So it's a logical way of doing it. It's a little time consuming. But the key to families would start here in the front. So if you bring in a flower, you want to know what it is, you could start right at the front of a book and use the key. There are some shortcut ways kind of to get started, and I know that's kind of how I started, are the picture books. And this is one for the North Cascades, Wildflowers 1. And you can just thumb through and do a picture match. And I've had a lot of botany, but I think this is fine. It works. It's a quick way to get down to your flower, and then you can learn about the family, and then you can go back and look it up in a book that has a key. You can work backwards. So this is a fun way to start. Again, wherever you live, you'll find a picture book like this that's for your area. Ocean shores, mountains, on the other side of the Cascades, there are lots of these books out. The one that is so great for our part of Washington, I live in Wenatchee, so we were sort of missing a good picture book for the flowers of our sagebrush grasslands. This is a new book out by Ronald Taylor, who's at University of Washington. He's sort of the person for knowing plants in sagebrush grasslands. So this has been a really neat addition. Again, it's a picture book, and you can go through. And this book is organized by families. So you find your picture, but then you go back and figure out what family it's in by the heading. This is the big scruff family. It's got a lot of pages. The figwort family. So you can go backwards in and figure out what family. So everybody who lives in Sagebrush Country is so happy that this book came out. It's just a really great addition. And then in the front of it is a really nice description of ecology and plant ecology and adaptations. And one reason to identify plants is to sort of figure out why they grow there. Why are they blooming in May? Why are they already died and set seed at the end of May? So those are sort of the interesting questions that identifying plants can get you to start thinking about. This is the tool that botanists use, and this is called Flora of the Pacific Northwest. And it amazes me to think how Hitchcock is the author, put this thing together. This is condensed. There are five volumes that, if you really want to get those, five volumes. And a woman did all of the illustrations, and these are considered to be just really state-of-the-art illustrations. I recently read a little biography about her life, and she was worked very closely with this botanist, and the meticulous detail. And everybody who's a botanist today uses these pictures. This is a big, giant key. You first have to start up in the front. This is the key to the vascular plants of our region. So you go through the front to figure out what family it is. If it's the scrof family, the figwort family we just looked at, we turn to page 413, and then we'd start all over again with a key. Here we are with the figwort family, and then you'd want to go through and figure out which genus it is. So the next subdivision down after family is genus, and they're about one page, and there are about 25 different genuses. And so once you've keyed to the genus, then you go to that genus, and the snapdragon genus, and this is a nice short one, there are only two choices. So if you found a snapdragon, you're lucky. I always breathe a sigh of relief. If you do the lupins, you've got five pages of lupins. Lupins are hard. So this is the next, if you really want to get technical, this is a really fun way to go.
Yeah. Do you have any idea how long it took her to draw all those?
Well, it was over a 30-year project. Mm-hmm. And in five volumes. And then she had to get all the specimens. They did the work from herbarium specimens. Our main universities have an herbarium, which is a collection of pressed specimens. And so you didn't have to have fresh specimens to do the work. But still, it's a phenomenal thing. And a lot of the, for example, to identify the forget-me-nots, you have to count the little nutlets, which is the little tiny seed, and what pattern they're at. So a lot of these drawings are microscopic enlargements, so you can see if there's a groove on the nutlet or if there's a crease. So it's an amazing thing, but this is if you really want to get serious, this is the route to go. This is a great way to get started. Another resource that a lot of national parks and state parks have are tiny keys for the flowers in their region. And I encourage the bookstore to get this one. This is distributed at Stehekin by the National Park Service, Mountain Flowers of the North Cascades. And they did a neat thing. They picked out about 30 common flowers, not all of them, but the ones we'd see when we're visiting the park. And then they made a simple key. They said, go through here and make three choices. First of all, pick a number for the color. So if you found a white flower, you'd pick one. And then go through and pick a number for the flower shape. So if it was a white flower that looked like this, we'd pick one again. So we have one, one. And then we go through and pick a leaf shape. Let's say it was two. So our number is 112. So you go through here, and 112 is cow parsnip. And this is a large plant that's growing in this area. So this is kind of a neat shortcut. So when you visit parks and things, take a look at their shelf. They usually have something that someone has done locally.
Did they order for it?
I don't know. It only costs 70 cents, but it's hard to find. It's one of those government publications that how do you track it down?
What's the name of it?
It's called Mountain Flowers of the North Cascades.
And they might have that upstate.
And I bought it at Mazam at the Ranger Station.
They might have it up at Stehekin.
I'm guessing they might, yeah. Weeds are a big component of our flora these days, so the Northwest Weed Books isn't a good book to have on hand. A lot of the things that we call wildflowers are in here is weeds. And a weed is simply a plant that's not native to an area that does really well. You know, weeds have the bad reputation, but really weeds are these really great adaptive plants that simply do better than the plants of their area. And probably the biggest weed around here would be the knapweeds and the silver star thistle. And they are, both of those were developed very early in the Russian steppe, the Russian grasslands. They came over in feed sacks and in seed sacks or on animals. And now all over the West, we have our knapweeds taking over, especially in the sagebrush grasslands. It's a tremendous problem. But also where logging's been done, anywhere a car has gone up, anywhere there's a disturbance that's opened up a pathway, weeds can enter. So weeds are an important component. And if you want to get started on trees, I think tomorrow about 5 o'clock, we're going to do a tree identification of the trees in this area. But this is in the bookstore. This is a $3 book. And I like it because instead of all the trees in the country, it's only the trees in Washington. So it's a real easy way to only have to have 18 choices. And tomorrow we're going to do some keying. So if you want to come and try out keying, this book has a simple 2-page key for the conifers, the needled trees, and then a 1-page tree for the broadleaf tree. So this is a real easy way, and we have such great trees right here. You know, you could get this book in the next couple days. Master 5 or 6 trees. And it's neat here because we can see big ones and small ones. The cones are out right now. It's a good time to learn trees. You also want to look at the bark, look at the needle, look at the shape of the tree. And this is a great place. I know I've been honing up on my trees up here, and I'm amazed at how easy it is to learn when you've got so many specimens. Well, I think we're just going to have them spread out on the table next door. I'll go get specimens, and I have slides to show. But I was thinking we might go out to the schoolyard because they're almost all of them are right there, depending on the weather.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Okay.
I think it's at 5 tomorrow. So I thought we'd just go through and look at a survey of plants that you might be seeing right now.
Again, this was put together by somebody that did intensive work at Holden on plants. Whatever this light is, I guess it'll probably be okay.
Now you can't sleep because there's a little light on. Oh, one more resource to tell you about. Somebody did the Wildflowers, Trees, and Shrubs of Holden Village, and I'm guessing it's the same person that did slides in 88. And my botanist friend who works for the BLM in Wenatchee told me there's some mistakes in here, not to take, don't take the species name for sure, but at least the genus name is there. And she did a simple key for the trees and shrubs and flowers here. And then you go through and you can get the names of them in this kind of a format. And it's in the library and it's in the Hike House. It's got a beat up yellow cover, but it's out of print. So if you find something, run to the Hike House, flip through the pages. That's another good way to get going. Okay, now this is brilliant right now. This is one of our fall color plants, and if you were here in another couple weeks, scarlet red leaves. This really is a beautiful fall plant. This is the mountain ash, and the genus is Sorbus, and this is a rose family. And if you take a look at the berry, notice this little projection right here like a rose has? That's one of the characteristics of the rose family, how that fruit forms.
Is it a flower in the spring then?
A beautiful white creamy flower. And I have the picture myself, and there wasn't room to insert it in here, but if you'd like to see it, we can look it up in the book. A beautiful white flat-topped umbel that blooms in mid-June. So look how quickly, mid-June there's a flower. Now by the 1st of September, berries are ripe. And on our way up to Heart Lake, we found lots of these in scat, piles of stuff on the trail, and one of them was big enough to have been a bear. These have a high sugar content, so they ferment on the tree, and they are a food source for wildlife during the winter.
Do birds eat them?
Yeah, birds, and also, well, birds, grouse.
They get drunk on them too.
They do, yeah. Now this is common all over. It's the first thing to come in after disturbance, and a mine is lots of disturbance. A lot of vegetation was removed for the mine. So wherever you go in Holden, you're going to find soil that was disturbed, and this is one of the first things to grow up. This is the Sitka alder. And this is the female flower, this tiny cone. And earlier in the year, there's a male catkin that makes the pollen. So it's a wind-pollinated shrub. This has nitrogen nodules in its roots, so it can live in very nutrient-poor soil. It enriches the soil, and then other trees can then use that nitrogen and grow. So it's an important early species to come in after there's been a disturbance. Real common along the creek as well as the road up to the mine. If you like to, these dry beautifully. If you want to pick some and take them home or glue them on there. My mom makes little tiny wreaths, gluing about 100 of those on.
What's the name again?
It's an alder. Now, you won't see this because this is the Pacific silver fir. This is about 100 feet off the ground. Fir cones sit upright, and then they basically fall apart on the tree. So you never get to actually hold one of these resiny cones. They come apart, and squirrels can go up to the top and take them apart on top of the tree. I think one of the trees, one of the silver firs on the way up to the chalets, if you look at the top, it looks like a stick sitting up, and I think the squirrels have been eating it up there. Notice this pattern of sort of clustering upward, and tomorrow we'll look at the actually needle pattern of the fir tree. This is that beautiful sweet smell in the warmness of when we've had hot sunny days here. This is the black cottonwood, and this is what it looks like in June. This is a seed dispersal mechanism using the wind. Here you have something billowy and very lightweight that the seeds are embedded in. The wind then can spread the seeds that way. This is a member of the same family as the aspen, and the leaves look similar. This has a rounded stem and the aspen has a flat. This is our biggest native deciduous tree, and it has to grow where it's wet. So all along the Railroad Creek here, we have big, tall groves of black cottonwood, and it's a truly beautiful tree that goes throughout the West as well as Washington.
But that's not the one growing on the trail up to 10 miles. There's a patch there.
Well, there's a patch of aspen there
in the rock slide.
Yeah. This is a bush that's growing in rock slides next to aspen. If you live on the coast, you may recognize this as ocean spray. We call it mountain spray because we're not by the ocean. This is a real beautiful, it's called Holodiscus discolor, and I noticed some nurseries are starting to sell this as a landscaping plant. I have one in my yard. A lot of people in the Northwest are trying to go to native vegetation that's more drought tolerant. This tree can survive on 15 inches of rain a year, so it's a good plant to grow down in the sagebrush area where I live. This is a fall flowering species. Now, most of the things, you notice there are not many flowers out now. Most plants bloom in the spring when it's warm. There's lots of bees, lots of insects for pollination. Quickly make their fruit, and then some plants totally die. The small wildflowers die. The shrubs, though, because they're woody, they can have access to more water. They have a bigger root system. This tree can take a different strategy, wait until fall to produce its flowers and fruit. And these will stay on the tree all the way through winter, all the way almost till the next year.
How about the leaves? Do they stay on?
The leaves do fall off. They're deciduous. And there's some up behind the chalets right now. It's a real beautiful white, creamy color. This is one leaf of, we have two maples here. We have the smaller vine maple, and this is the vine maple. And it is gorgeous in another couple months. If you've driven through the east side of the Cascades in October, the bright red splash that you see are the vine maples. It's a very hardy maple. It grows all the way down in sagebrush country where you get 10 inches of rain or less. So it's an incredibly drought-tolerant maple. There's another species that is a real entangling species over on the west side, but this is our east side vine maple. And you'll see it up just as you're walking up the road as an understory. This is a small shrub, or small tree, large shrub. It's not truly a tree. This is the ceanothus, or mountain balm, and the flowers were in June, and they're very smelly. Not that pleasant of a smell, but it's a very pungent, recognizable smell. These are growing at the base of ponderosas down on Lake Chelan. This is a common shrub in our lower elevation forest, all the way up to this 3,000 or 4,000 foot elevation forest. This is a fire adapted tree. The seeds, when they fall to the ground, have to be scarred by fire to sprout. So we don't have a lot of reproduction by seed, but if a fire does come through and kill the plant, kill the top of the plant, the seeds then are able to sprout and regenerate that way. Also, if the top of the tree is killed, it will resprout from its base.
Are we going to have an incursion of those because of the fires in the Chelan area?
Well, this is very common in the Chelan area. We know it will come back because it's got those two fire-adapted characteristics.
Is it a tree or shrub?
Well, it's a large shrub, and you'll see it just up behind the garbology if you go up to that road. I'm going to skip that one for now. This is one of our dogwood family trees. We have two dogwoods here. One grows down by the creek and has the red twig. Maybe you use it for landscaping. It's the red Oyser dogwood. It grows with very wet feet, and you can see it from the footbridge, this flat-topped white flower. We also have the larger tree dogwood that if you come in early June, you might catch a few glimpses of the blossoms. It's not really common. It needs a little more water generally, so it's found in real moist hollows or along the creek where it's cooler and moister. And this is what you'd see now if you go look at the red Oyser dogwood down by the creek. It's an important food crop for wildlife, birds, not so much mammals, but birds use it in the winter. In our east side of the Cascades, we have two common wild roses. Notice the spines. And again, the rose family has very many seed-producing, it produces the fruit is going to be produced in here, and what those little brown things that stick out at the end are the remainders of these. So it has a fruit that develops underneath the flower, and that's one of the characteristics of the rose family. Oregon grape shows some adaptations for dry climate. Notice the shiny leaf. This is a ground plant that is a perennial. It doesn't shed its leaves in the fall, all of them. Many of them turn and turn red. They do turn brown, but a few always stay on. So you'll still see the leaves, but each year it does grow new leaves, especially on the tips. And this is the lemon-tasting sour berry. Usually, notice these holes. I've never picked an Oregon grape to eat it that doesn't have a little hole in it. So it's commonly used by insects for food. And I don't think it was used too much by the Native Americans. My grandmother used to, when I was thirsty, say, have an Oregon grape. You know, it's that lemon sour pucker taste. But I'm not sure it had much other use.
Do we see those up here?
I've seen them. They need sunnier spots to look on the higher, well-drained slopes. I know on the hikes when you're traversing up some rock slides on the way to Heart Lake, we saw some.
There's some right on the way to Monkey Bear Falls.
Okay, great. There are quite a few different species of Oregon grape, and they grow all the way down to the lower edge of our forests to about the 1,500 foot level. This is a beautiful little flower that is circumpolar. It was named by Linnaeus, who's the father of botany. This is the little twin flower, and it is a trailing, vine, and it grows in low light, so you'll often see it when you're in a dark forest. It will be one of the ground covers, and it's one of my favorite. I know there's some, I don't know if you recognize this, there's China that has this painted on it. It's just a beautiful flower that's both in Northern Europe as well as here.
Was that Kinnikinick?
No, that was twin flower. And I'll show you Kinnikinick in a minute. Or excuse me, twin berry. It's twin flower, right? Twin berry is another one. This is the wild strawberry. We do have a couple different wild strawberries that grow from 2,000 feet up to 7,000. And I'm not sure which species grows here. Again, they do produce small berries. They're very delicious. They're very tiny. So they're used mostly by mammals and birds.
What is the genus?
Fragelia. No, Fragaria. Fragaria. And then this is our wild bluebells, Mertensia. Down in the sagebrush, we have a little tiny Mertensia with the same flower. And then you come up to 2,000 feet along moist creeks, and you have this tall, sometimes this tall, bluebell. So this is typical around creeks. It blooms in June. It started to wither away already. When you're looking around a creek, you'll see some kind of brown stuff, and it's some of these annuals that come back. And this is a perennial. Our sagebrush Mertensia is an annual. That means the seed sprouts, grows, and dies each year. This has a rhizome underneath the ground that stays alive. And if you live up here at this elevation and you have a long period of snow, up to 6 to 7 months of snow cover, it makes more sense for a bluebell to be a perennial, to not have to start over every year, to already have some stored food supply to send up the growth. This is blooming right now. This is an example of a weedy species. This is, if you walk up the road, you'll see these, some butter and eggs. It's kind of called an alien. It just grows really well where there's been disturbance. It can kind of come in. It's windblown. It was native somewhere in the West. It wasn't really native up here, but now that we've had people moving in and out and soil moved, we've got it here. So it's one of the few flowering annuals that we have.
We saw a lot of that up at the old miners' village.
Okay, good, yeah. Go ahead.
Is it a snapdragon?
It's very good. It's a snapdragon family. And you're starting to, you recognize the shape of this flower. So that's your first clue. You go in the book to the snapdragon family to figure it out. This is Pearly Everlasting. There's only one member of the genus that's here. It's in the composite family, the sunflower family, which is tremendously large. This, again, is an opportunistic plant. It grows where there's disturbance. If you've ever been on logging roads, roads that have been logged in the past, this will be blanketing both sides of those roads. And again, on any roads in mountainous Washington where they've done snow plowing or where they've moved up the soil, this is one of the first things to come in. You can dry it, you can pick it, turn it upside down, take the leaves off, and it will then preserve. And it, again, is an annual. It grows up from seeds each year, and these are wind-dispersed seeds. Thimbleberry is one of our larger, tiny shrub, I guess, a tiny shrub, or one of our larger flowers. It produces a berry that's, maybe you've seen them, they're out now, they're deep red, they look like a raspberry, but they're sort of flattish. They taste very bland and mealy, but they were an important food for the Native Americans, and they would use them to make pemmican, a mixture of berries and meat mashed together. So this was used for food, and it's used for berry food. Again, this is starting to begin to be used for landscaping. I just ordered 10 this year from a nursery and put them in my yard, and I'm really happy with the nice ground cover I've gotten with the thimbleberry. And this is the rubus, which is a currant family, with the currants, raspberries. And there's a picture of the fruit. And you can eat them, so give one of those a try. One word of caution, when you're out in the woods, you really don't want to eat any berry unless you know if it's edible or not. So make sure you know it's a thimbleberry before you pick it. This is the flower of the snowberry. Right now, if you notice some white berries covering a lot of the low-lying shrubs under the drier parts of the forest. A beautiful pink little blossom. Let's see, I think there's a... Nope, they didn't give us a fruit. But as you walk up to the mine, look for some little white berries. They're a very important forage food for wildlife in the winter. This is a real common underneath ponderosa pines down at Lake Chelan, about 2,000 feet and lower. It's a common forage plant. And then it comes all the way up. This is about the upper limits of its distribution. But I've noticed it behind the garbology a lot in there. And then this is the serviceberry. Maybe you know sarviceberry, juneberry. This grows from the Midwest all the way over, and it was an important Indian food. It produces a blueberry. Most of them now are gone. I put one on the bulletin board this morning. I could only find one berry on the shrub that I found. So they are used for wildlife. They also fall off. They dry up and fall off. We don't use them much now. Most people don't pick sarvice berries or service berries. It's one of those, it just doesn't have much of a taste. It's a rose family shrub again. And it grows very well with 10 inches of rain or less. In Wenatchee, where I live, it's what I look up and see in my ravine. And I also took a picture of one of these at 6,000 feet up on Icicle Ridge. So it's got a really wide range of where it can live.
How big do these get?
Well, they are large, large shrubs. They get to be as high up as that black pipe down in the sagebrush where I live. And then up at 6,000 feet, it was only this big.
There are lots of them along Ten Mile Creek Trail.
Okay, good. And thinking about that, Ten Mile Creek is a south-facing slope. So for this area, that's the hottest, driest, very well-drained hillside. So that is the most arid climate, so you'd expect to find these more arid-adapted plants there. And there are the service berries. Good, there were some fruits. This is one of the members. This is Tansy. This is another weedy species. It's it is an overtaker. Do you recognize that from home? It's pretty much throughout the U.S., especially in the West. Again, you can cut it and turn it upside down and dry it. It has terrible odor, so I don't want to dry it outside for a long time before the smell goes away. But it's a member of the composite family, the sunflower family. If you were here in June or July, you would have seen lots of different paintbrushes. This is the member of the scroff or the figwort family. It has that tubular flower. These are really hard to key out. There are over 100 different Indian paintbrushes. So what? And I'm going to skip on because we're getting close on time. A couple more I wanted to show you. Let's go to this one. This is our wild columbine. And it grows with bracken fern. You can still see the leaves. The flowers bloom June, July, in the way to Holden Lake. There were lots of them growing on the rocks. It's probably one of our prettiest native flowers that's all throughout the Cascades, this east side of the Cascades. And another common flower along creeks as you're hiking up is this monkey flower. And it's still in the flowering stage. Notice the tubular flower. So it's another member of this figwort family, the scroff family. And it has some little brown spots here. That's for this particular one, to figure out which species it is, you have to look at the brown spot pattern. Botanists always pick different kinds of things to tell apart the species. So whoever made up this key went for the spots. Now this grows in wet soils. Fireweed. Now fireweed, now if you look around, you'll see, instead of the purple flower, you'll see this white pluminess coming off. And it's their seed dispersal. The seeds are then in this white feathery material that's being wind blown. And here's another one of the Indian paintbrushes. And I just want to skip ahead real quick. Skip ahead. If you want to look at some of these, we can. The bleeding heart, many of you grow it in your gardens at home. This is the native species that grows, blooming quite early in the spring, up along the boardwalks above the ballpark. It's a good place to see it. This is one of my favorites, the spring beauty. Starting about 2,000 feet in our conifer forest, this is the first bloomer. So it's really exciting when you first see in late March, early April, this spring beauty coming up. It's the Portulacaceae family. And phlox. We have lots of phloxes that grow in our sagebrush grasslands, and then all the way up into here. They can tolerate very little moisture. They grow up in the alpine zone. They're a cushion plant. They have lots of ability to avoid being dried out. So a lot of plants that we see in dry deserts, we also see up in alpine zones because they have the same kinds of dryness, different temperature regimes, but a lot of unavailability of water. This one, I haven't seen it around. It's a common, it's called goat's beard. It looks a lot like the ocean spray, but it's got this spike coming up. And it's another one that has a late summer bloomer, same color. But I'd like to see one of those right here. I haven't seen it. And this is another monkey flower that's a purple. This picture's deceiving. They look a little more purple, but they grow in moist areas. So we've just kind of looked at a survey of the kind of things that are here. It's sometimes overwhelming, you know. I try when I'm trying to learn new plants, I just try and do one at a time. And every hike, if you learn one plant, after a summer, you've learned 10. And those become your friends, and you know them, and you start to recognize them. So it's a great hobby to start on. And one reason I like to do it, it's a great form of relaxation. You forget the other stuff that's worrying you because you're looking at this thing of beauty. It's a great technique for just stilling your mind. And I know I use it that way a lot. And again, I remember places that I've been, I can just see in a snapshot on my head this particular flower. Maybe the first time I saw this flower. So it's a neat way when you're traveling to sort of punctuate what you're seeing. I know with young children, I'm really glad I like to look at flowers because you walk slowly. And I know as I get older, I'll walk slowly too. So. Going slowly is the only way really to do botany. So it's something we can all do kind of throughout our lives. Well, thanks for coming. And if you want to look at any of the books.
There are no anemones that grow
Well, we have a beautiful anemone. It's a windflower. It looks like a witch's hair, and it grows about 6,000 feet and higher. And I can show you a picture of it. It's a real odd-looking, kind of a silly-looking flower.